Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Jason Croft is at the controls. It seems that much of the violent conflict in the world today has either nationalist or cultural dimensions, in some cases both. And there would have been a time, there certainly was a time, when a lot of scholars believed that as more countries industrialized, became modern, become part of the global economy, that ethnic conflict would simply disappear. However, it seems the contrary is true. It seems that these kinds of conflicts only have become more intense and raise the question, can ethnic warfare be prevented? And what sort of role is there for outsiders to play in trying to mediate these kinds of conflicts? These are a couple of the questions that we'll discuss in this part of Focus 580. As we talk with Ronald Suny, he's professor of political science and history at the University of Chicago, and is particularly interested in the history of the Soviet Union and Russia and the various republics that made up the Soviet Union. He's authored a couple of books dealing with these subjects, including The Revenge of the Past, Nationalism, Revolution, and the Collapse of the Soviet Union, and another, The Soviet Experiment, Russia, the USSR, and the Successor States. And he's particularly been interested in his research and writing on non-Russian nationalities of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union, particularly those of the Caucasus. He's here visiting the campus, is going to give a talk. His visit sponsored both by the folks at the Russian and East European Center, and also the Departments of Political Science, History, and the folks in the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. I think I've mentioned everybody. He's giving a talk on the topic, Why We Hate You, the Passions of National Identity and Ethnic Conflict, that will take place this afternoon at 4 o'clock at 101 of the International Studies Building, and I'm sure that anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by. And here, of course, on this program, your questions are welcome. We just ask people to, you know, try to keep comments brief and questions to the point, and that will really help us in including as many people as possible and keep the program moving. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much.
Happy to be
for
here.
Being here. Maybe the place to start is with this idea that, and I guess it's sort of my impression, my understanding, that there were a lot of people who said, you know, as the world becomes more modern, as nations industrialize, as nations become part of the global economy, that the kinds of conflict along ethnic lines that we have seen in the past, people said, well, that's just going to go away. That's going to fade away. And it hasn't. If anything, it seems that we see more and more of those kinds of conflicts. So that really raises the question, why? Why is it that this kind of conflict seems to be on the increase with us more and more?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right that, in fact, there were these predictions, both by sort of liberal modernization theorists, people who thought that with modernity, what would become important is, social well-being, other problems of the economy and so forth, and ethnicity would fade as a mark of distinction. And also among Marxists, and socialist theorists as well, that, you know, with modernization, class would become important, all of these things. The idea of the melting pot was prevalent in American political thought. It turns out that many of these ideas were just sort of wrong-headed. Now, even though we're entering a globalized world, you know, so in some ways national boundaries do seem less important, at the same time, it's very clear that since 1945, ethnic conflict and it sort of intra-state rather than interstate conflict has grown. It turns out we know statistically that whereas up to 1945, up to the end of World War II, most people were killed in interstate wars, right? World War I, World War II, you're talking about 16 million in the first one and about 40 or so million in the Second World War. Since 1945, it turns out, most people are now being killed, and we're talking about hundreds of thousands and millions of people in civil wars and ethnic conflicts. Suicide bombings, those kinds of things. That is, interstate wars, the kind that we just had with Iraq, is in fact on the downswing, so to speak. Maybe we should be thankful for that, right? But since 45, largely in some part because of the standoff between the two great superpowers, right? During the Cold War, at least, there was a balance of terror, and the big states didn't fight one another. You had these sort of brush wars and third world wars and so on. So you're asking a very difficult question. First of all, right, you're right. It's on the increase. Mm-hmm. And it's not accidental that people used to study or do study international affairs have turned to the study of ethnic conflict and nationalism and using many of those tools. And then the question is, why is this so? And there are a lot of different answers to this. One is that first of all, in the process of decolonization, that is, when great empires sort of gave up power over, you know, other societies, tribal societies, mixed societies of all kinds, and empires were pretty good about mixing people together, right, because there weren't borders between different nationalities or ethnicities. When those empires gave up power, there was a kind of state of what you might call anarchy. That is, there was no overriding authority now to keep different peoples from getting at each other's throat. And so, in fact, you know, you take something like the Russian Empire or the Soviet Empire. When the Soviet Union collapsed, Armenians and Azerbaijanis now sort of took off after one another. Ukrainians and Russians, they settled their conflicts, you know, relatively peacefully, or Tatars and Russians settled them pretty peacefully. But there were conflicts. A place like Chechnya, however, and Russia, there was no resolution of that problem, and they've gone to war, and tens of thousands of people have been killed. So that's one big reason for that.
One of the things that I think makes this confusing and difficult to understand is that I'm not certain that there is any conflict that's purely ethnic.
Good point.
And that there are, you know, when you look at the things that people fight about in a lot of these conflicts, it seems that they're fighting about the same things that people always fight about. Who gets the good stuff? You know, it's about who is in charge, who has the control of the important resources. Maybe some people would say, well, yes, it's true that some of these conflicts that we see within states, that is, groups that are competing within states, really don't have as much to do with ethnicity as they might seem. That what they're really about is about struggles for power and leaders within various groups using, in some cases, nationalist tensions that have been latent for a long time, fanning the flames, and using that to get what they want, which is power. I think a lot of people have said that's the short explanation of what happened in the former Yugoslavia.
This is a very shrewd point. I think you're actually right on the right track. That is, first of all, if you look at much journalism, or you look at some what I would call relatively conservative views of ethnic conflict, then you see that they talk about things like ancient tribal struggles, you know, conflicts that go back into the primeval past or something of the sort, as if, you know, these conflicts are simply renewals of old conflicts. And many people who write about the fall of empire, the end of the Soviet Union, say, well, you know, the Soviets put this lid on conflicts, but it's the same people hating each other. Well, it turns out, yes, there are conflicts that repeat old conflicts, and you're more likely to get a conflict between two groups at the present time where there had been conflict in the past. So there is some correlation there. But in fact, these conflicts, when you actually do a kind of what we call in political science a large N study, or you do lots of different cases statistically, you find out that ethnicity or culture is not a particularly strong predictor of conflict. Other things are predictors, you know. Mm-hmm. For instance, the more prosperous an area is, the less likely you are to get conflict. The more democratic an area is, the less likely you are to get conflict. And here's a good one for you. The more mountains you have, the more likely you are to get conflict. Well, because you can hide in the mountains, right? I mean, it makes conflict possible. So Illinois doesn't have to actually worry about this too much, right? But there aren't a lot of big predictors like that, but there are some. Now, it turns out that when you have collapse of state or you have weak states, that is, again, you don't have this overriding authority, then you're likely to get conflict. So even though democracy, it will tend to lead to non-conflict, the transition from an authoritarian regime after the fall of an empire to what might be a democratic regime, that is, the process of democratization, is fraught with conflict. people have to get the rules of the game right. Mm-hmm. So you've got different peoples around. They're standing around thinking, you know, what's going to happen in the future? Those guys over there don't look like they're very friendly to us. Maybe we should do something first, the idea of preemption, of acting first. And very often that's the problem. But David, you said something I think very, very accurate. The conflicts are mostly about, not about my culture has always hated your culture, you know, or you've done this to us in the past and we want to get redress, but rather over goodies of some kind, like territory. Armenians and Azerbaijanis have had a conflict now for the last decade over an area called Karabakh. It actually happens, my grandfather is from that area. And they've been fighting over this area. This area of Karabakh was in the Republic of Azerbaijan in Soviet times. But it was full of Armenians. 75%+ were Armenians. So the Armenians have a claim to that area that is demographic. You know, we're the majority there. Azerbaijanis have a claim. No, that's part of our territory. This is territorial integrity. It's international, law principle. Both of them make historical claims. We were here first. Apparently, if you got to a place first, you have a claim of some kind, right? So they have all these conflicting claims. They fought a war over it. It's actually about who's going to control that territory. Now, it turns out Azerbaijanis and Armenians have, for much of their history, actually gotten along pretty well, managed to live together. Not always. In 1905 and 1918, there were conflicts and massacres in 1918 by Azerbaijanis of Armenians. After the Soviets fell, there were again clashes, pogroms of Azerbaijanis against Armenians. Armenians took revenge by driving all the Azerbaijanis out of Armenia. So there are clearly clashes. But what they're fighting about is who is going to have political control over that territory.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is a story that got a fair amount of coverage right in the time right after the Soviet Union came apart. Perhaps because people were saying this might foreshadow what was going to happen in the future, because here we had this vast collection of small states and peoples who were culturally and ethnically very diverse that had been all held together by the Soviet government. But when that was gone, it looked like the thing was going to start to fly apart. All of the states wanted autonomy, and then within states there were groups that wanted autonomy.
Right.
And there was I think a lot of people were really concerned that there could be a lot of violence as everyone sort of jockeyed for their position, and various sorts of groups said, "Well, here we want to make sure that we're autonomous in our particular area." That was the story where we seemed like we were heading. And then I can't recall last time that I actually read something about, for example, this conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan, or too much else other than Chechnya. There also are separatist independence movements in Georgia. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there are in some other places. But what has happened now? Just let's talk about Armenia and Azerbaijan. What has happened with that?
Well, you're right. In fact, when the Soviet Union was falling apart and when it actually collapsed and broke up into 15 different independent republics, the prediction was there's going to be, you know, hell to pay, right? That is, it was going to be conflict all over the place. You had tens of millions of Russians living outside of Russia proper in these non-Russian republics. And there may have been resentments against these people. Many of them would go back to Russia. Well, it turned out those conflicts didn't occur. There was almost no real retaliation taken against Russians. That's one thing. Secondly, there was a thought that Islam, the Muslim peoples of the former Soviet Union, would rise up again against Russians or Christians or something. Well, very little of that actually happened against non-Muslims. Right? Muslims did not actually attack non-Muslims. Very few cases of that. Actually, Muslim peoples, traditionally Muslim people, because after 70 years of Soviet power, religion was not that relevant or was only for a few people. But peoples who had been traditionally Muslims actually fought with other people who had been traditionally Muslims. So you had Kyrgyz and Uzbeks clashing out there. But many of those conflicts, too, have sort of faded away. Now, where you have conflicts, at the moment, the worst one, as you mentioned, is Chechnya. Right. This, by the way, is a brutal struggle. This is a devastating policy on the part of the Russians, who are doing real horrors to a people who is, of course, a constituent people of their own republic, the Chechens, and something like 50,000 people have lost their life. The city of Grozny has been destroyed. Chechens are disappearing or being disappeared, you know. There's all kinds of atrocities taking place, of which the world is largely unaware, except for human rights activists. The Chechens have responded, as you know, with suicide bombings, with the seizing of the theater in Moscow, with all kinds of horrors on their side as well. And Putin, the president of Russia, has taken a personal interest in this conflict. He is unwilling to negotiate with the Chechens. They've had phony elections there to try to keep Chechnya and a kind of puppet regime in power. So this is a really bad case. But I'm happy that you asked about Armenia and Azerbaijan, since it's something that I've written about and I care about a lot. In 1994, the Armenians basically won the struggle. Now, Armenia is a republic about half the size of Azerbaijan, but it's a very nationalistic republic. They managed to mobilize people. They had the majority in Karabakh, and they won this little war. And the Russians negotiated a truce between Azerbaijan and Armenia, and that truce is largely held. Few skirmishes here or there on the borders, and so far so good. There have been attempts by the European community, by the OSCE, the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, to come out with some final solution, but neither side seems able to come to the table with a plan. I have my own ideas of how they might solve that problem, but that's a separate issue. In any case, it's a stalemate. It's been a stalemate now for almost 10 years. Right now, the old president, the old communist leader of Azerbaijan, Haydar Aliyev, has retired from power, and in a kind of phony election, manipulated election, his son, Ilham Aliyev, has become the new president. It's interesting that after communism comes what we might call sultanism, right? Mm-hmm. You hand power down to your heir, your oldest son or something like that. And we don't know what's now in the cards. Everyone is standing fast or waiting to see what's going to happen. But right now, the conflict is on hold. Mm.
Just real quick, and I have a caller I'll get to, that I think that some people said, well, part of the reason, maybe the primary reason that Putin took such a hard line in Chechnya was that within Russia, there are other places, there are other groups of people who are also thinking about autonomy and would like to, you know, to go their own way, the way the Chechens would. And this is Putin's way of saying, anybody who tries this, this is what's going to happen. If that is indeed the case, is it the case that elsewhere in Russia, there are other places where people would say, well, you know, I think we believe in autonomy too. We're a distinct group of people and we feel that we would want to go more our own way and would pose a kind of a challenge to the government in Moscow.
Russia is a country in which 80% of the population are Russians and 20% are non-Russians. So it's heavily a Russian country. But there are very many areas which are at least nominally in the hands of or are considered the homelands of different peoples. So there's Mahdi El and there's, Sakha, where the people of the north live. There's Tatarstan and so forth. Some areas, at least two others, Tuva and Tatarstan, have thought about more autonomy or even some people talked about independence. Those were negotiated with the central government and arrangements were made. Autonomy was given. The non-Russian peoples have all kinds of autonomy within Russia. In fact, some Russians resent how much they actually have. They have various tax rights and control over local resources. We have what we call asymmetrical federalism in Russia. Different parts of the country have different rights and different degrees of autonomy. It's unlike the United States where you have symmetrical federalism. Every state basically has the same relationship to the federal government. Chechnya then was the only place which didn't get a negotiated settlement. Now, they were asking for full independence. My own reading is that there were moments along the line where they could have negotiated some other kind of settlement. But some Russians very much feared this sort of vociferous process, whereas if they be given to them, others will take more. So that could be part of it. Secondly, Chechnya was imagined, or let's say was constructed in an image as a place where banditry, violence, and the favorite word now, of course, of politics, terrorism was rampant. These were, and you can hear this with Russians, criminal people. Well, once you start envisioning people as terrorists, criminals, and so forth, these are not people you're going to negotiate with. These are people you have to beat. And I remember I was in Russia just this summer, and we had a wonderful guide taking us around in St. Petersburg, civilized woman, art historian, lovely. And we were talking about this, and we talked about Catherine the Great, and everything was fine until we entered the topic of Chechnya. And then banditi, terroristi, she kept, you know, these are not human. They killed their own guests at their own table. I mean, she would tell these stories, fantastic stories about the Chechens. Now, here's a people who had been oppressed under the Tsars, under Stalin. They were driven out of their homeland by Stalin into Central Asia, brought back by Khrushchev, who again are being crushed. Their own city, built by the Soviets, by the way, has now been bombed into ruins. Well, you know, with those kinds of attitudes, there's not going to be any kind of solution to this problem, it seems to me. A negotiated solution is possible. It would require patience, generosity. It would require giving Chechens great autonomy. Let them call it independence if they want. It wouldn't be independence. Ultimately, states are not going to give up pieces of their own territory. That creates other kinds of problems that we don't want to get into. Mm.
Well, I should introduce again our guest, Ron Suni. He's professor of political science and history at the University of Chicago and is particularly interested in the politics and the history of Russia and the former Soviet Union. He's here visiting the campus. He's going to give a talk this afternoon talking about issues of nationalism, ethnic conflict. And that's part of what we're talking about here this morning. Questions are welcome. We do have somebody who's ready to go. Others are invited. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois or Indiana. 800-222-9455. Here's an Urbana caller, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I have two related questions. One is this oil tycoon that was jailed by Putin recently. Do you happen to know if he was Jewish?
He was. Mm. He is.
Well, in that case, the second question is particularly relevant then, and that's taking issue with your idea that democracy lowers the possibility of conflict. And what I'm referring to in particular is a recent book, World on Fire, by Amy Chua, which you may be familiar with. She points out that, well, to quote from a review here, free trade, financial liberalization, and privatization have concentrated enormous wealth in the hands of, quote, market-dominant minorities, the Chinese in Southeast Asia, whites in Latin America and South Africa, Jews in post-communist Russia, Indians in Kenya, the Igbo in Nigeria, and so on, and that this is policies have generated dislocation, insecurity, anger, and destruction because now people can vote against these, quote, market-dominant minorities. And I would point to Putin's jailing of Khodorkovsky, I think his name is, as an example. Could you reflect on her position on democracy and peace?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It very often, there will be in capitalist societies, you know, certain groups who will end up at the bottom and certain groups will end up at the top. That is, there'll be a kind of congruence, a kind of correspondence between, let's say, ethnicity or race on the one hand and economic position on the other, right? So, you know, minorities in this country tend to be more at the bottom, certain minorities at the bottom, maybe others at the top. In Russia, in the post-Soviet world, many of the so-called oligarchs or very wealthy men happen to be Jewish. The five or six richest people, most of them are Jewish. And that may be a reason for some targeting. Now, Russia is a country in which anti-Semitism has been widespread for a long time, so they don't need necessarily this particular excuse. But it adds to the flames. And there are other kinds of stereotypings of people. For instance, after the fall of the Soviet Union, the sort of free-for-all economy that they had, certain groups, often on ethnic lines, would join together to control certain industries, certain markets, etc. So you had a Chechen mafia or a Georgian mafia. They called them mafias. That would control the markets in this area or that. Azerbaijanis controlling some markets in Moscow. And this created resentments, you know. Whether this statistically was dominant, it was something that was visible that people understood or they saw, they perceived it that way, and they would turn their wrath on these groups. And so occasionally the Russian government has rounded up what they call Caucasians, not white people, as we understand Caucasians in this country, but people literally from the Caucasus, and they would drive them out of the city. So this kind of stereotyping targeting certain groups because of their visibility in the economy, that has actually happened over time. Now, I see that as part of the process of marketization, privatization, democratization. It's the process that sort of changes the rules of the game, that changes people's social status, those kinds of things that lead to these kinds of resentments. But notice again, the targets are chosen and thought to be ethnic or Jewish or religious, or so it could be a religious thing or an ethnic thing or something like that. But in fact, it may be much more about economics, a feeling of resentment of being left out or underprivileged. I'll give you an example from Armenian history, in fact. Armenians were such a minority, sort of a bourgeoisie, a middle-class, entrepreneurial group in the Ottoman Empire. And they were very prominent. And Turks, who were not as well off, resented this Armenian middle class that sort of made it, this group. Now, it turns out, if you actually looked at it, most Armenians in the Ottoman Empire were peasants, just like Turks. Turks were peasants. But a few were visible, successful people in the capital. And that few then caused resentment on the part of Turks, who felt, what is this? This is our empire. Muslims are supposed to be on top. Armenians are supposed to be these non-believers underneath. Everything has gone upside down. In other words, this is called a sort of status reversal. The lower groups have gone on top. The groups that were supposed to be on top have gone down. And that created resentments. And that may have fed in to the kinds of massacres and killings that ultimately culminated in 1915 in the first genocide by the Turks of the Armenians, the first genocide of the 20th century.
So, I kind of think that Amy Chua's got a hold of something here with the idea that democracy can actually increase the possibility of conflict. And just a parting shot here, I think it's interesting that nowadays, when there's so many minorities in the United States, there's an exhibition at the U of I Chicago Art Gallery about entitled "After Whiteness," where they're pointing out to quote them, white hegemony has been one of its most integral components has been its presumptive occupancy of the norm, its taken for grantedness, and so they're trying to put whiteness into a kind of ethnic identity, you know, to point it out, and which would put, you know, us into a conflict situation. But just thought you might be interested to hear that. Thank you.
All right. It's an interesting idea. When you talk about ethnicity, you're always talking against something which is considered the norm. So, you know, what would it be in our country? White Anglo-Saxon Protestants or something. Though they may insist that they're an ethnic group too, you know, they have their own customs and so on. But in any case, it's always something. It's like we can talk about women's problems, but that's against the norm of men. The normal way is men. So there's always that kind of thing. It seems to me that what I'm trying to emphasize here is that people construct other people in ways, whether or not they actually are that way. And it is against that sort of image that they've created that they may, in fact, launch some kind of attack. For instance, in the Armenian-Azerbaijani conflict, I come back to this because it's one I know well, Armenians talk about the Azerbaijani pogrom in 1988 against Armenians in the city of Sumgayit as a genocide. Now, Armenians suffered a genocide. They see Azerbaijanis as Turks. They always call them Turks. They are a Turkic people. They are not Anatolian Turks. They're not the Turks who committed the genocide. But they label them Turks. So they label them something that, you know, to link them with past wrongs that were done to Armenians. They link this pogrom in which a few dozen people were killed, a terrible, horrible event, with a genocide in which nearly a million people were killed. And by doing so, they increase the intensity, the emotion of that conflict. So what I'm saying is what you've got to look at in any conflict is the way in which people are constructing that conflict, what images they're using, what kinds of emotive meanings are they given to what they perceive as the enemy. If they're Jews in among the richest men in Europe, in Russia, what does that say? It says a few Jews have been lucky or skilled or corrupt or whatever to become successful. What does it actually say about most Jews? Not very much, but you can project that. You can make that mean something far beyond what it actually is.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Way back at the beginning, we talked about the fact that there was a time when people said, well, you know, these kind of conflicts, over time, as the world becomes more modern, as we have economic, cultural globalization, these kinds of things are going to go away. I suppose there are now some people who would be prepared to argue that, in fact, globalization not only did it not make things better, it actually made things worse. That somehow there is some connection between globalization and increase in ethnic conflict.
I'm not so sure. I think that first of all, globalization operates in lots of different directions. It's a big process. I've never actually been able to sort of get a firm handle on what people are talking about. You know, that's a problem. But look what's actually happened. In some parts of the world where there's been breakdowns of state authority, so Yugoslavia fell apart. You got conflict because Serbs wanted a bigger Serbia. Croats wanted to be independent. Bosnia is one of their own state. Macedonia and so forth. Right? Mm-hmm. You got conflict. Russia, you had some conflicts as well. You didn't particularly have one when Czechoslovakia fell apart in what's called the Velvet Divorce. You don't have, for instance, conflict between Romanians and Hungarians, even though they're no longer under communist regimes. They should have conflict. Why not? There are Hungarians in Transylvania. They had conflict before. They negotiated their way out of it. In other words, we never hear about the places where the conflict doesn't take place. If every nationality or every ethnic group or every cultural group had a conflict with its neighbor, you'd have tens of thousands of potential conflicts. We've got a handful of them, right? That's one thing. Another thing, look at other parts of the world. Look at Western Europe, right? Western Europe has moved under this globalizing effort toward breaking down borders. Now, if I had said to you in 1945 that in 50 years, Germans and Frenchmen, who had just fought the Franco-Prussian War, the First World War, the Second World War, and had conflicts that went back to ancient Gaul, and the barbarians and all. If I told you that in 50 years these people would not even be able to conceive of a war between them, that there would be no effective border between them, you can cross the border at will, and that they'd be sharing a single currency and be thinking of joining political units and institutions as well, you'd say in 1945, you said, you're some kind of left-wing utopian. It's impossible to think of that. And of course, it's happened in our own lifetime. I'm old enough to remember, right, to go back to World War II even. So it seems to me what we've got is situations, particular situations that need study. First of all, I don't think there's any global explanation of ethnic conflict. There seems to be some rough correlations if you take lots and lots of different areas of conflict between, as I mentioned, democracy, prosperity, and mountains, right? Doesn't tell you a lot. But if you look at a place like India today, where there is quite vicious ethnic rioting and urban rioting between groups defined not as ethnic, because they're not language groups, but as religious groups. Okay, so that's the marker. Well, then you got to go back and find out why is that happening, you know? Mm-hmm. And what you find is there are very, very complex reasons why, in fact, people are willing to kill other people on the basis of Islam or Hinduism.
Let's talk with some others. Let's go to Terre Haute over in Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Yes. As always, your program is very interesting. I wanted to make some comments about the Chechnya situation. I was over last year in Krasnodar, Russia, and I gave a lecture in the Kuban University to journalism students. And at the end of the lecture, I asked for questions, and one girl raised her hand and asked me what I thought about my government's position on Chechnya. And I said, the government's position as I see it is roughly what the guest speaker is. And I said, well, I was opposed to it, and I knew something of what was going on. And I started to explain myself, and then she interrupted, and she says, do you know that the I came from from Grozny, and the Chechens came to my house, or our family, and gave us 3 days to leave Grozny. And then later on, I met another family there. The father was a information officer for the Krasnodar City Duma, and he and his daughter told the same story, that they were given 3 days to leave, and by the Chechens. And another family I met in Krasnodar this year when I was over there, they were refugees also from Grozny, and I asked them, well, how long did you have to go? Well, they had been given a couple of months, or were warned by Chechen friends of that. And and then a lot of the Russians tell me that the Chechens are savages, like their nickname, they say, is the wolf, the wolves. And they point out that there's a big difference in their ethnicity from other Muslim groups, like the Adigeyetsi, and who are peaceful and have normal relationships between the men and the women. And they point out that the Chechens, they're brutal to their wives, and it's strictly male-dominated society. And, well, then the other thing I wanted to comment about is the Chechens say that they're doing this because of discrimination under Tsarism, and also because Stalin moved them out of Chechnya and settled them someplace else, like we resettled the Japanese. But on the same day that the Chechens were resettled, they resettled the Koreans into Kazakhstan and other places. And the Koreans have made a good readjustment all over and are contributing to the growth and prosperity of Russia, but not the Chechens. So I just wanted to ask your opinion or rebuttal of that.
Well, first of all, it's not accidental that Russians who are in this conflict with the Chechens and ordinary Russians who daily hear on the media about the savagery of the Chechens against Russians, but not about the savagery of the Russians against the Chechens, have very negative views of the Chechens. What's very interesting is there have been very few reports of Chechen atrocities against Russians. The city of Grozny was largely a Russian city, that is, Russian, ethnic Russian in population, and they got along well with Chechens. But now the war has taken such a brutal turn that I wouldn't be surprised that these reports that some militant Chechens, you know, that is, there are now Islamic types and even foreigners, there were various people came from Arab countries and so forth, Mujahideen types into Chechnya, have radicalized this conflict and have ordered Russians to leave the city at a certain point. I haven't actually heard about that myself, but I don't doubt that that actually has happened, because the struggle and the conflict has taken on such a terrible cast in the last couple of years. So that's possible. But What I'm saying is the Chechens, the idea that Chechens are brutal to their women and all the rest, these seem to me are stereotypes based on this demonization that's taken place in the media. I remember, and it affects everyone. Now, I'm sympathetic to the Chechens and to people who are struggling against oppression, like the Palestinians against the Israeli occupation and so forth. But it's funny, even my attitudes are sometimes affected. I remember once, I was in Moscow about a year ago, and I was introduced to an anthropologist at the Institute of Ethnography. Very distinguished man, looks a little bit like David sitting here with a very trim beard, very elegant Russian. We began speaking, and I said, "Where are you from?" And he said, "I'm from Chechnya." And turns out he was a Chechen. And I realized I had never imagined a Chechen to be an intellectual and to have this kind of refined manner and to be a scholar of some kind. I myself had thought of Chechens as these, you know, rough mountain people. But, of course, there are all kinds of people in Chechnya. Very similarly, when I was once in Ramallah in Palestine years and years ago, in the former occupation that the Israelis had in that city, I was giving a talk. Actually, it was supposed to be at the university, but the university had been shut down that day by the Israelis, so we held it secretly in a house. And as these people came in, graduate students and faculty, and I heard these intelligent questions, and we had a fascinating discussion that could have taken place on the campus of the University of Chicago, I realized my own stereotypes about Arabs, which I thought I was over, in fact, affected me. And I was surprised and pleased to find out that, you know, they're intellectual and interesting people in among the Palestinians. So you can imagine in a country like Russia, where the media is controlled and limited and where Putin is cracking down on opposition and critical media, the views of Russians is terribly, terribly distorted. Not unlike the way in this country much of our media is now becoming increasingly foxified. So we're getting more and more skewed view about the rest of the world.
We're coming into about our last 5 minutes. And one question I do, as a way of trying to have some closure to the topic, I do want to ask this. When we see these kinds of conflicts, we often, that is, the international community feels we really should do something. If people are dying, we should do something about that. We're concerned about that just on the face of it, and also because of the possibility that these kinds of conflicts can contribute to regional instability, and we have seen how they can draw in their neighbors, and pretty soon we could have something that started out as a local conflict becoming a regional conflict. So it is our impulse to want to do something, but that we know that that's extremely difficult. There are issues of national sovereignty. When you get into a conflict like that, there are people no doubt are going to say, well, it's none of your damn business, and go take care of your own country. It's very difficult to understand the dynamics of these things. So if you decide that you're going to intervene, how exactly do you do that? Is there some way that we can, as an international, as a world, an international community, we can get better at trying to mediate these kind of conflicts, and perhaps even prevent them before they start?
I think there is. The first question I have to ask or think about is, who is the we?
Are you talking about
the international community? Are you talking about the UN? Are you talking about the United States? Let's start with just the United States. Because the United States has a very mixed record on the way it deals with these conflicts. In Chechnya itself, I remember when there was the first invasion of Chechnya by the Yeltsin government. Bill Clinton was then the president, and he said that Yeltsin is like Abraham Lincoln, you know, trying to keep his country together and so forth. And I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times, you know, against that point of view, because this was a very special conflict, you know, and it was carried out quite brutally and could have been negotiated. In other words, it seems to me the United States must be more consistent, given its own ideals and its particular extraordinary power in the world today, to defend what are considered international human rights standards, so that we must be against these kinds of atrocities that are taking place. Now, we don't criticize Putin very much right now. Oh, there are reports in the State Department reports, but why don't we? Because, first of all, he's an ally, and President Bush has looked into his eyes and seen his soul, and he's a good man, as he's told us. Mm-hmm. And also because Putin has constructed this conflict as a struggle against terrorism. Now, as soon as you name your enemies terrorists, then you can do all kinds of terrible things. The same that Sharon has done against the Palestinians. They're terrorists. Therefore, you can shoot them down from helicopter gunships, invade their cities, destroy their homes, and so forth. So it seems to me that there's a real deep inconsistency. At the one hand, we're fighting this terrorism. Terrorism is a good thing to fight, right? It's an important thing to fight. I wish it were done by police agencies rather than thinking of it in terms of war, but that's another question. But on the other hand, we are inconsistent about defending human rights in all places. It's a very good book by Samantha Powers about America and the question of genocide. We had a chance in Rwanda to, if not initially stop the genocide, to prevent it from going on so long. And yet we sat back and didn't do it. It took us a long time to think about going into Bosnia. Eventually we did stop that conflict and we prevented perhaps something in Kosovo. Let me just try, David, to answer the question, though, about whether intervention. I, at this point, with the United States now in Afghanistan and in Iraq and with all the problems, I'm not particularly in favor of these kinds of interventions. I think there are many things you can do short of war. And the danger to the world and to a population has to be imminent and clear before you actually do such a thing as cross borders and challenge the sovereignty of another state. And it should never be done, it seems to me, without the sanction of international bodies like the United Nations. And my threshold would be quite high. I would say if there's active genocide going on, then a strong power of the United States should put all the pressure it can on the international community, on international institutions, to go and do something quickly. Short of that, we should be negotiating, we should be thinking, we should be acting, as I wish we had done before Iraq. And now, of course, the chickens are coming home to roost, and we understand that this may have been an error.
Yeah. Well, there was much, much more that we could talk about, and I wish that we had more time, but we have come to the end. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest here this morning, Ron Suny, he'll be giving a talk dealing with some of these very themes this afternoon at 4 o'clock in room 101 of the International Studies Building. That's on South 5th in Champaign on the U of I campus. The folks at Russian East European Center, Political Science, and Arms Control, Disarmament, International Security all sponsoring his visit here. So I'm sure that it would be open to anybody who would like to attend. That's, again, 4 o'clock this afternoon, 101 International Studies on the U of I campus. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was great.
I appreciate it.